Garcia versus Church of Scientology Flag Service Organization. Mr. Burlington?
Yes, this is Mr. Burlington. I represent the Garcias, plaintiffs below, and your appellants in this court. First, I want to address this court's order of July 15th, which raised a jurisdictional question, and I think the answer to both questions is yes. This court's PTA case makes it clear that when a district court has jurisdiction at the time it grants a motion to compel, it retains jurisdiction to confirm or vacate the award as to the original parties. And in that case, there were additional parties who were not parties before the court that participated in the arbitration that did nothing to deprive the court of jurisdiction. Now, PTA did not address the Vaden case, but prior to the Vaden case, every circuit court which addressed the issue determined diversity jurisdiction for purposes of Section 4 petitions based on the citizenship of the parties before the court and any indispensable parties that were or should have been joined. Since Vaden, circuit courts that have addressed the issue again have determined that Vaden did not alter that analysis for three reasons. One, the holding of Vaden expressly limited its ruling to federal question jurisdiction. The court did not overrule the Moses H. Cone case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, which the circuit courts had looked to for some guidance on this issue in the context of diversity jurisdiction, and the courts have noted the practical considerations of implementing the Federal Arbitration Act if there are additional parties added during an arbitration and other possibly involved in the lower court. So we believe that the answer to both of this court's inquiries in the order would be yes. I would like to move on to the merits on the procedural unconscionability. The trial court specifically found it was an adhesion contract, and we never waived that issue, as I explained in the reply brief. That in itself is not sufficient to declare procedural unconscionability, although it is a strong indication under Florida law. The second aspect is there were no rules or procedures for how the arbitration would be handled. There never had been an arbitration in Scientology history. None of L. Ron Hubbard's writings used the word arbitration. The Committee on Ethics never used the term. They never showed a single Scientology document that ever used it, defined it, or applied it. And what happened was the trial court specifically ruled, and this is at the ruling at docket entry 265, page 3, that the International Justice Chief would determine the manner of proceedings during the arbitration. And that is a very clear demonstration, not only that there were no rules or procedures in the arbitration agreement, but furthermore, it reflects the fundamental problem of getting a valid agreement from my clients as to the arbitration and ensuring some fairness and predictability. So we believe we proved procedural unconscionability, and those two factors should have resulted in that determination. As to substantive, it's undisputed there was a lack of mutuality. That was conceded by the defendants in a lengthy colloquy before the court. That's at docket entry 129, pages 41 through 43. And also in the deposition of the International Justice Chief, which was read at the evidentiary hearing.
Did you make the mutuality argument when in your pleadings at the trial court? And did the district court make a determination on mutuality such that we would be able to review that finding?
Yes, we did. In the opposition to the joint motion to arbitrate, at page 8, footnote 3, we had a discussion of Florida law. At the time, we believed California law applied, but we had a lengthy discussion of Florida law and specifically noted that lack of mutuality in itself is sufficient to constitute substantive unconscionability. Additionally, at page 14 of that opposition, we noted Scientology authorizes civil actions against suppressive persons. Additionally, there was a separate bench memo that we filed for purposes of the evidentiary hearing. That's a docket entry 170. At page 5 of that document, we quote the testimony of the International Justice Chief, who acknowledged that Scientology retains the right to sue their members or past members, and we argue that in the context of substantive unconscionability. Additionally, at the evidentiary hearing, the issue was raised again, and as I noted earlier, there was a testimony that we put on of the International Justice Chief on that exact point, and in the prior hearing, the judge, knowing that this issue had been raised, had a lengthy colloquy with defense counsel where they conceded that nothing bound Scientology to arbitrate any claims. They would arbitrate if the member had a claim that they wanted to pursue. So it was fully raised in the trial court at each level, recognized by the judge, and the judge clearly ruled on the issue. The argument that the First Amendment somehow infects or limits the...
Counsel, I'm sorry. Can you show me where in the district court's order compelling arbitration that the trial court, Judge Whitmore, made a finding on mutuality?
Oh, there was not a specific finding in the order. There was a colloquy in which it was established. There was not a specific finding. But they conceded it, and they don't dispute it in their briefs before this court. They simply say that we never raised it, which is clearly inaccurate. Moving on to the First Amendment, they've cited no cases that there's any limitation on a district court's ability to determine the arbitrability or the validity of an arbitration agreement. It's determined under neutral principles of contract formation and unconscionability, which is done under contract principles. We've cited the Michelle case, which specifically stated that this determination is based on neutral principles. They've cited no cases to the contrary. Beyond that, because the primary claims here involved claims of fraud, it's significant that this court noted in the Church of Scientology case that the state has a compelling interest in protecting church members from misrepresentations designed to obtain their money, and that specifically applied to voluntary members, and even if the money was used for legitimate purpose, which we don't concede here, of course. Also, the U.S. Supreme Court in Cantwell.
2 minutes remaining.
Said that nothing implies that persons under the cloak of religion may commit frauds. So there was no prohibition from the court applying neutral principles in the context of this case. As to the vacature, we go into detail in the briefs, and it is very clear that despite their representations to the trial court, the CVB board rules applied despite them telling the court it would not. We were not allowed to present witnesses, even though they told the court we would, and we were not allowed to originate all the evidence we presented despite representations. And I will rely on my brief for the remainder.
Well, I think the main concern I have in this case is about whether you submitted enough evidence about whether the lead arbitrator was evidently partial that would have required an evidentiary hearing. That seemed to me to be your strongest argument.
Well, I appreciate that, and based on the fact that my clients have been declared suppressive, that had obviously severe consequences, but it was also the three arbitrators themselves and the manner in which it was held, where they were repeatedly accused of high crimes. They were told of
what I'm concerned about is what that arbitrator said. According to your client's affidavit, he said, I know what's happening here. There are a lot of
suppressive persons out there trying to destroy our church. One of those has fed you all these lies. One of your compadres sent me a bunch of and used an expletive. Check it out, and it was, and used it again. So don't you go telling me I don't know what's going on, because I do know. You've been sold a bill of goods. All of that, it seemed to me, should have prompted the district court to hold an evidentiary hearing and figure out exactly who was telling the truth about what happened there.
I appreciate that, and I probably have negative time left. So I
we'll hear from Mr. Lieberman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Eric Lieberman. Let me begin by addressing the court's question concerning the PTA FLA cases. The short answer to the court's questions are no and no. Here, unlike PTA, the arbitration that took place was not the, quote, resulting arbitration from the court's order compelling arbitration. Rather, it was an arbitration on different issues raising different questions and different claims against additional parties over which the district court already had determined it lacked jurisdiction. The Supreme Court's made plain that subsequent actions by a plaintiff can destroy jurisdiction in a diversity case. For example, Owen Equipment versus Kroger,
diverse defendants named in the original complaint were dropped. The amended complaint had only diverse defendants. The amount in controversy exceeded $75,000. What am I missing?
Well, because the arbitration that actually took place wasn't that case. The arbitration that took place was the complaint against non-diverse parties, which the district court had already found over which it did not have jurisdiction. Plus, the arbitration added an additional party that had nothing to do with the original case, that also was non-diverse, from Orange County, California. If the plaintiff had brought those claims, which he originally did, before the district court could not have had jurisdiction. The resulting arbitration was not, there was not a resulting arbitration. There was a separate arbitration because it wasn't what the district court ordered. In PTA, the court condemned the gamesmanship of the plaintiff, who upon losing the arbitration attempted to deprive the district court of jurisdiction to confirm the result of the very arbitration it had ordered. Here, the gamesmanship of the plaintiff exceeds that of that in PTA. Three times the plaintiffs have reversed their position and their claims in an attempt to create jurisdiction that does not exist. Here, unlike PTA, the question of supplemental or pendant jurisdiction was not raised or decided by the district court, nor under the circumstances of the case could it have been. In fact, as the PTA case court warned, Congress was wary of gamesmanship on the part of a plaintiff, not defendants. The drafters were concerned, quote, about encouraging plaintiffs to evade the jurisdictional requirements of the diversity statute by the simple expedient of naming initially only those defendants whose joinder satisfied the jurisdictional requirements and later adding claims not within the original federal jurisdiction against other defendants. That's precisely describes what plaintiffs have attempted here. The Garcias have engaged in blatant gamesmanship to expand the court's jurisdiction. The proper question here must proceed from the recognition in numerous cases, including Moses Cone and Vodden, that the FAA does not expand jurisdiction. That rule is what must inform how the court considers and applies PTA. PTA could not have held that the district court that compels arbitration always retains jurisdiction to confirm or vacate an arbitration award in some arbitration that is not the arbitration that was contemplated that it ordered, only that it retains jurisdiction to review an arbitration resulting from its order. Any other result would fly in the face of the core rule that the FAA does not confer general jurisdiction. That is what happened here. Now, I'll briefly turn to the arbitration itself.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
If you don't mind, let me get you started on that. I have a concern about the whether the rules of arbitration, and the form and procedure of arbitration were adequately set forth in the agreement. And I wanted you to address, if you could for me, the notion that the district court had, which was that the conduct of the religious arbitration will be decided by the IJC at the appropriate time during the arbitration. In other words, it sounds like the IJC was making it up as he or she went along. And how does that provide any kind of notice of the form and procedure of arbitration, particularly when this is the first arbitration, so there's not a prior one to look at?
Okay. The district court reviewed applicable Florida case law on what the minimal requirements are in terms of the procedures that must be set forth in the arbitration agreement. Those requirements are that the agreement sets forth how the arbitrators are selected, the numbers of arbitrators, and what matters are to be arbitrated. In addition, the agreement says that the arbitration shall take place in accordance with the procedures of the Scientology justice system.
And so I would think that would be fine if there were procedures of the Scientology justice system. But from the district court findings, it doesn't seem as though there were existing procedures at that time and that that was something that was going to be determined during the course of the arbitration. So what could the parties, what could the plaintiffs have relied upon in order to know what the procedures would be, since no arbitration had previously been conducted and since the IJC was going to make them up as he or she went along?
Well, I don't think that the court contemplated the IJC was going to make them up as they went along. The court pointed out that the plaintiff had studied extensively Scientology policies and writings on the justice system. The court noted that while the rules of the committees of evidence don't govern here, that nevertheless the IJC had testified extensively that he would use those, he would borrow from them as appropriate to follow through on this. Moreover, under Florida law, quite simply, what the agreement provided is what has been held to be sufficient under Florida law, and the district court adhered to that very specifically.
I don't see that. What is the case that you rely on for that proposition?
Well, there were a number of cases in our brief.
Well, what's your best case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I have to...
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Lieberman, it seemed to me that the Greenbrook case from one of the DCAs said that as long as the arbitration agreement is definite enough that the parties have some idea as to what matters are to be arbitrated.
That's right.
And here we know from the agreement that it's any dispute, claim, or controversy between these parties, and that it provides some procedure by which the arbitration is to be effected. Well, we know how the arbitrators were supposed to be selected, and the agreement provided that the arbitration would be conducted in accordance with Scientology principles, which, as the district court found, your adversaries knew and understood.
That's right.
That
that's enough, isn't it?
Yes, that's precisely right.
That well,
let
me ask you a question about that. If it's going to be conducted in accordance with Scientology principles, and Scientology has no arbitration principles yet because it hasn't established them other than how to select panel, how does that tell what the procedure of the arbitration will be?
It, under Florida law, that is what is required. It doesn't require a great deal of detail as to what the procedures of the arbitration will be. It requires that you know how the arbitrators are going to be selected, how many arbitrators there will be, what the subject matter of the arbitration will be. That is all that's required under Florida law. The district court followed that very clearly.
I agree that Florida law requires the form and procedure for arbitration. I'm just concerned about where this sets forth what the procedure is. I mean, the idea is so that the parties can know what the rules are going to be and everybody can be informed about them. For example, you know, if you say that you're going to go by the American Association of Arbitration rules, that would be a form and procedure of arbitration. If you say you're going to go by the Scientology arbitration rules, that would be a form and procedure of arbitration if such rules existed. The problem I'm having is that the rules did not exist. Maybe you can address that.
Well, Your Honor, as I said,
Does Florida law require that it be definite arbitration principles, or would it be enough for it to be Scientology principles?
That's precisely right.
Doesn't Scientology have to have some kind of arbitration principles in order
It has principles relating to the procedures in justice proceedings, which the plaintiff studied extensively. The plaintiff agreed that this was that he agreed with these principles at the time he entered into the agreements. He agreed that he would be that he would submit disputes with the church to a panel of Scientologists in good standing. He agreed to that. He said he agreed with it at the time. That's all that's required in an arbitration.
Let me ask you about this arbitrator, the lead arbitrator, and what Lewis's affidavit suggests was his evident partiality. Shouldn't the district court have conducted an evidentiary hearing about that?
I don't think so.
If you take that affidavit as true, shouldn't he have had a hearing to sort it out?
Well, Your Honor, I think that even if it were true, it was indicated in the course of a dispute in the arbitration that arbitrators are not expected to be like judges.
Two minutes remaining.
That the record demonstrates clearly that the Garcias had every opportunity to submit whatever evidence they wanted. They were they did not submit evidence at all on their fraud claims. They did not make any argument that any specific evidence improperly was excluded. They left the arbitration early without submitting evidence. They made no complaint to the arbitrators or the IJC that they were being treated arbitrarily or unfairly. They didn't say, why aren't you letting us submit this evidence? Because, in fact, they were asked to submit whatever evidence they wanted in whatever form. They left the decision addressed each of the claims they had made. The decision found that they were not credible, that they hadn't made out their claims. They didn't even try to make out their claims, quite frankly, Your Honor. And nevertheless, the panel awarded them over $18,000, contrary to the church's position, which I think demonstrates that the arbitrators were not biased against them merely because of their position against the church. In fact, legally, they would be considered the prevailing party in this case. So
the time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lieberman. Mr. Burlington, you say 5 minutes.
This is Phil Burlington on behalf of the plaintiffs. The Garcias engaged in absolutely no gamesmanship. When we went into that arbitration, we had no idea the boundaries, either procedurally or substantively. It's well established the arbitral forum is not bound by Article 3 limitations.
Well, you knew from the agreement that this was that any dispute that your clients had with the church were to be arbitrated. You knew how the arbitrators were to be picked.
No, we only knew from whom they would be picked, which was, it did not say how, and ultimately here, because of that problem, the trial court had to actively pick them. Sorry.
Each committee was supposed to pick an arbitrator, right? And then those two selected would select a third. And the chief was supposed to select any arbitrator that the parties or the other arbitrators failed to designate. Isn't that right?
I think that's more than was in the agreement. I think it was that there would be three arbitrators who were Scientologists in good standing. We weren't even able to get through that portion. There may have been those other provisions, but it never got that far. There were no rules on how it would be handled. His description of what happened at that arbitration is absolutely false. We presented our evidence. 90% of it was eliminated. We complained. They didn't care. They attacked my clients during the arbitration by the arbitrators. And they claimed all along that these other parties were indispensable parties and relief could not be granted to the two diverse defendants, and we ran the risk of going to arbitration and have them rule on that basis. So we included those parties. They were completely free to say that's beyond the scope of the federal court's order. And when we went back in the trial, yes?
Counsel, sorry, this is Robert Luck. What is the legal standard for evident partiality in terms of the statute allowing a district court to vacate an arbitration award?
Okay, under Section A2, and it's to be applied stringently, is evident partiality or corruption. And the case law is clear that we are entitled to have the right, to have impartial arbitrators. We did not give up that right by agreeing to arbitration. So it's a question of basic impartiality.
Can I ask you something? When the contract itself calls for members in good standing, and as your clients know, and as we all know now, at least I've learned, that if you're not a member in good standing, you're a suppressive person, and therefore there's some restrictions on communication and other things. If that's part of the agreement, then aren't you in essence agreeing to someone who has at least some partiality in favor of the church?
They claim that it would be impartial, and they told the trial judge it would be impartial, and that these people would overlook that.
That's what the chief testified, right?
Sorry?
That's what the chief testified to, right? That was what was required.
Right. That, well, and that they would be instructed to be impartial, and yet they were given the CBP report that accused my clients of high crimes totally unrelated to these claims, in addition to other scurrilous materials. And one other thing I have to say, we never asked the district court to expand its jurisdiction. When we went back to vacate it, we only sought that relief.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to go again for a moment to the issue of the procedures of the arbitration. Opposing counsel relied on Greenbrook, but in that case, isn't it true that the parties adopted the Florida Arbitration Code as part of their procedures, so there was already a prepared code that everybody could look to? Do you think there's a difference between that and this situation?
Yes, it is completely different. And the case that should control is the Spicer case, a Florida District Court case, where an employment situation, the arbitration provision set forth the arbitrators and said the procedures would simply be done under the tenant fair treatment process, which was the company at issue. They claimed they had some process. There was none. It was declared procedurally unconscionable. That case should control. His reliance on Greenbrook doesn't help him, and there's no case that helps him. It's only fair that people know the manner in which an arbitration is going to be held. It is not intended to be simply a free-for-all. It is intended to be a valid substitute for their civil claim, and no case under the FAA has ever said that the party who holds the arbitration has free rein in entire proceedings and how they treat those people. And sure, I'm way over my time.
Counsel, your time has expired.
You are not way over your time. You ended right on time.
Oh.
Mr. Burlington, good job.
Thank you.
We have your case, and we'll be in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you.